So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Monia Zard, the Deputy President of Clubs and Societies at Imperial, who will be introducing our speakers and hosting the evening.
Thanks, James. So I'm just going to briefly explain the format of the evening. We're going to invite each speaker to present their arguments. We're going to hear first from Dr. Hugh Ross and then from Professor Lewis Walpert. Then there'll be a brief period of discussion where each speaker can ask questions on what the others said. Then we'll open up the floor to Q&A. And then finally, we'll allow brief concluding remarks from each speaker before you can all go and have more refreshments and maybe look at the bookstall at the end. So I'm first going to just introduce both of the speakers. So first we'll be hearing from Dr. Hugh Ross from the University of Toronto. So at age 17, Hugh Ross became the youngest person to serve as Director of Observations for Vancouver, Canada's Royal Astronomical Society. He completed his undergraduate degree in physics at the University of British Columbia and in graduate degrees in astronomy at the University of Toronto. He was then a postdoctoral research fellow at Caltech, researching quasars and distant galaxies. He's addressed students and faculties at universities around the world, from Texas A&M, which awarded him the Trotter Prize earlier this year, to MIT, Yale, Stanford, University of Illinois, and many more, as well as research institutes such as the Fermilab and Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's the author and co-author of more than a dozen books, including More Than a Theory, Why the Universe Is the Way It Is, and The Origins of Life. Professor Lewis Walpert, the second speaker we'll be hearing from tonight, was educated in civil engineering at the University of Witwatersrand and then studied soil mechanics at Imperial College London and finally moved to cell biology, so quite an illustrious career, at King's College London. He currently holds the position of Emeritus Professor of Biology at University College London and is known for his numerous scientific and research publications. He's also presented television programmes on BBC Two and was made a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1980. He was awarded a CBE in 1990 and made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 1999. He's also the Vice President of the British Humanist Association. So now I'm going to invite Dr. Hugh Ross to speak and present his arguments.
Well, it was 26 years ago that we founded Reasons to Believe, and it's an organization that develops brand new scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. We do that through a feature called Today's New Reason to Believe. It's free. You can get that at our website, and also we have podcasts where typically we jump on new scientific discoveries within hours after they've been announced and show how they provide more evidence for the Christian faith. And these days, you don't need a computer. You can get all this through an app, which gives you access to all of our podcasts and magazine articles and today's new reason to believe. We've got some cards over there on the table that you're welcome to take with you that give you a brief review of some of the best scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. And also, you can use that to subscribe to all the things I've been talking about. And if you fill it out, we'll be happy to give you a CD which describes how astronomy brought me to faith in Christ 8 years before I met any Christians. But the theme I've been asked to address this evening, is there cosmic evidence for God? Or put it another way, can science test creation? I mean, you've probably heard the charge that creation is not science because it's not testable, it's not falsifiable, it's not predictive, which is why for the past 25 years we've been building a biblical creation model that is testable, falsifiable, and we show how it predicts future scientific discoveries. Now, often in exchanges like this, we think it's a debate about design. And actually, it was Paul Davies, a British physicist, who wrote back in 1986, "The impression of design is overwhelming." The debate is not about design. We see design all over the scientific spectrum. The real debate is who or what is responsible for the design that we see. And really, we need to come down to two questions in terms of emerging scientific evidence. As we learn more and more from the record of nature, is the evidence for the Creator's existence shrinking or growing as we learn more? We would argue that the evidence for God would be accurate if indeed scientific evidence for it increases. And has that scientific evidence grown to a point where we can eliminate some or all the alternate explanations? Are we simply talking about an ill-defined intelligent designer, or can we identify it as one of the gods of the major religions of the world? Now, the first book I ever read in cosmology was when I was 7 years of age, by a book by Sir Fred Hoyle, Nature of the Universe. And he comes from a Hindu worldview perspective, but in that book he made the following statement. There's a good deal of cosmology in the Bible. It is a remarkable conception. And when I was 17 and 18, I went through the holy books of the different religions of the world. And when you look at the Bible, it has more than 10 times the content on the origin and structure of the universe than all the rest of the holy books of the world combined. But there's four themes that the Bible explains in some detail and with a good deal of repetition. And so let me review the four fundamentals of biblical cosmology. One that I'm sure you're familiar with is the Bible declares a singularity beginning. That's a physics term which means an actual beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. What I found in the other holy books is it talked about God creating within space and time. In the Bible, it's God creating independent of space and time. And also talks about how we live in a universe that continuously expands from a space-time beginning. Under constant laws of physics, where one of those constant laws is a pervasive law of decay. Now let me just briefly review for you where you can find this in the Bible. In terms of the singularity beginning, I've found no matter where I travel in the world, everybody seems to know in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. They may not know the phrase, the Shamayan Ares, heavens and earth, refers to all of physical reality, including space and time. And the word create, bara in Hebrew, means to bring into existence something brand new that never existed before. Hebrews 11:3 in the New Testament says that the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. Well, what can we detect in science? Matter, energy, space, and time. And there are other passages that actually speak about a literal space-time beginning when God creates the universe. Now, I was reading the Bible for the first time when I was 17, and that was the very time when physicists here in Britain were developing the first of the space-time theorems. That took place in the 1960s, and probably the most famous of those developments was this paper, The Singularities of Gravitational Collapse in Cosmology, published by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, which concludes with the following. If mass exists in the universe, and if general relativity reliably predicts the movements of bodies in the universe, then space and time must be created by a causal agent who transcends space and time. Now again, the other religions speak about God or gods or cosmic forces creating within space and time that eternally exists. Where the Bible stood alone is saying the beginning of the universe is the beginning of space and time itself. And so this theorem, given that mass exists in the universe, and all of you are living proof that mass indeed does exist in the universe, some of you a little more so than others, and then if general relativity reliably predicts cosmic dynamics. When this paper was published, we could only prove general relativity's reliability to 1% precision. Today, we can prove it to 15 places a decimal. In the words of Roger Penrose, general relativity ranks as the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in all of physics. And today, we have over 30 of these space-time theorems. In fact, over a 10-year period, two physicists, Arvind Borde and Alexander Vilenkin, tried to find some loophole where we wouldn't be forced to accept this causal agent beyond space and time as a creator. And they did find some models of the universe that didn't demand that creator, but they were models of the universe that would not permit the existence of life. And they wind up developing this space-time theorem, inflationary space-times are incomplete in past directions, which states that any universe that expands on average has a beginning in the finite past and must be created by this transcendent causal agent. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking an inflationary Big Bang or some quantum Big Bang, quantum mechanical Big Bang, any universe that expands on average over its history must be created by this agent. which led them to conclude all reasonable expanded universe models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems. Now, this is significant because so much of science today is predicated that we can only presume natural causes. But notice what we're seeing here. We're seeing incontrovertible scientific evidence for the biggest miracle that any scientist could ever hope to uncover, the coming into existence of all of physical reality, which means scientists no longer can presume that all causes are natural. Clearly, this transcendent causal agent has miraculously intervened at the beginning of the universe, which means if he did it once, he could do it again and again and again thereafter. So we need to be open-minded in our scientific research, not only to natural causation, but also to supernatural causation. Now, as much as the Bible says about the beginning of the universe, it actually says much more about the expansion of the universe. Now, typically in the English translations, it comes across as God stretching out the heavens. But the Hebrew verb there is a verb nata, which means the expansion of whatever is being described. And it's in all three Hebrew verb forms, which means these are not metaphorical references. They're literally referring to a continual expansion of the universe. Now, at age 18, that caught my attention. As a young astronomy student, I realized this was unique to the Bible for over 2,000 years until Albert Einstein came along. For 2,000 years plus, the Bible stood alone in declaring that we live in a continuously expanding universe. And a number of years ago, I wrote a book called The Creator and the Cosmos, where I laid out the best evidence that we live in a continuously expanding universe. I don't have time to go through that tonight, but let me just give you a visual demonstration. These are two Hubble Space Telescope images, one of galaxies that are 12 billion light years away, and one of galaxies that are 2 billion light years away, and I purposely put both of these images to scale in terms of their geography. And what you can see is that 12 billion years ago, the galaxies were jammed so tightly together, they're literally ripping spiral arms off one another. But if you move forward 10 billion years, the galaxies are spread so far apart where that is now an extremely rare phenomena. And of course, we got images all the way in between, demonstrating that we actually do live in a continuously expanding universe. The Bible got it right. And in seven different places, the Bible tells us that we live in a universe with constant laws of physics. Here's one example. God speaks and he says, I've established the fixed laws of heaven and earth. And one of those fixed laws is this pervasive law of decay. How in Romans 8, the whole creation groans subject to its bondage to decay. Now again, that caught my attention during my teenage years because if we have a space-time beginning and the universe continuously expands from that beginning under constant laws of physics, where one of those laws is this pervasive law of decay, what you might call here the second law of thermodynamics, or lay people, Murphy's Law, how things tend towards decay. But what that predicts is that the universe would get progressively colder and colder in a highly predictable rate. So simply knowing the age of the universe, we would get a biblically predicted cooling curve for the universe. So this is an example where the Bible sticks its neck out and makes a numerically testable prediction of what we should expect about the cooling off of the universe. And so the solid curve there you see is a biblically predicted curve, and overlapping it are 13 measurements astronomers have made of the past temperature of the universe, and you can see how well the observations fit the biblically predicted curve. Now today we actually know what physical features of the universe govern the expansion of the universe. Namely, it would be the mass of the universe and something that's been discovered just 12 years ago, dark energy. Dark energy, we now know, makes up about 3/4 of all the stuff of the universe. It's the self-stretching property of the space fabric of the universe. And it's where we find the most spectacular evidence for fine-tuning design to make life possible. And it's in this context. If you expand the universe too quickly from the cosmic creation event, gravity will never be able to compress any of the gas to make stars and galaxies. The universe would be forever dispersed gas. But if you expand the universe too slowly, then gravity will collapse all that gas into nothing but black holes and neutron stars. Notice in both cases, there's no possibility for life. For life to be possible, you have to have galaxies, stars, and planets, and you want the right kinds of stars and the right kinds of planets to show up in the universe at the right time in cosmic history. This requires an exquisite fine-tuning of the expansion rate throughout all of cosmic history. And a number of physicists have calculated the degree to which you have to fine-tune the mass of the universe and the dark energy. But in terms of the dark energy by itself, the fine-tuning exceeds the best examples of human engineering design by at least a factor of 10 to the 98 times. And that means that, well, I'm making this point because so many of my fellow physicists and astronomers will say the space-time theorems prove a deistic God, but not a theistic or a personal God. They say, sure, there's a causal agent beyond space and time, but who says that that causal agent must be a personal God? Well, I would argue this does, because what we're looking at is a causal agent beyond space and time that is able to design and to create to a degree far greater than what we human beings can manifest. Now, in my opinion, the best example of human engineering design is a gravity wave telescope situated in Louisiana and in the state of Washington, and now they've got a third arm in Pisa, Italy. This machine was designed by brilliant Caltech and MIT physicists. But here in dark energy, we're looking at a causal agent that's 10 to the 98 times, that's 10 trillion, 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 trillion times more intelligent and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT physicists, or to put it another way, that many times better funded than the U.S. government that made all of that possible. And I think you can catch the drift here. When you're identifying the properties of intellect, intelligence, knowledge, creativity, and power, and care for what you're creating, those are attributes that can only be fulfilled by a personal being. So not only is the cosmos able to establish an agent beyond space and time that is able to create, but establishes that it's a personal being. Now, you might expect that this would be a logical conclusion coming from a Christian astronomer. But the fact is that this is a conclusion that's also being conceded by atheist theoretical physicists. I've got here a paper written by three atheist theoretical physicists titled Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant, another term for dark energy. And let me just pull for you three quotes from these three physicists. Number one, arranging the universe as we think it is arranged, that is governed by dark energy, would have required a miracle. Now, that's a fairly significant statement for three atheist physicists to make, but they go on to say an external agent, external to space and time, intervened in cosmic history for reasons of its own. Now, that's why you see the title of the paper, Disturbing Implications. They said this conclusion that there's an agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own is so utterly disturbing that they wound up concluding their research paper with this sentence, that the only reasonable conclusion is we do not live in a world that is a universe with a true cosmological constant. In other words, they concluded their paper by saying dark energy must be wrong, because if it's real, then we're stuck with this agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own. Now, the irony of this paper as it was published just months before astronomers developed 9 independent observational demonstrations that not only is dark energy real, it's the dominant component of the universe. Here's a list of those 9 confirmations that were made within the 6 months after this paper was published. I'm not going to go into the technical details. I don't have time. But if you go to our website, you'll see articles that we've written about these 9 different observational demonstrations where we cite the original papers, and actually you'll find an additional article where we go through 17 independent observational verifications that not only is dark energy real, it's the dominant component of the universe. Now, this is one example, but the truth is every constant of physics we look at shows similar evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. So here are a few examples. All four forces of physics must be fine-tuned. So for example, to have stable burning stars, a critical requirement for life, it's crucial that we fine-tune the value of the electromagnetic force constant relative to gravity to better than one part in 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion. Again, that exceeds the best example of human engineering design achievement. And the list goes on. Now, one of the ways you could put this to the test is that if this is really evidence for the God of the Bible, we would anticipate that the more we learn about the universe, then the longer this list will grow. And we began surveying the scientific literature in this context back in 1991. At that point, 17 different features of the laws of physics and the characteristics of the universe showed this very high level of fine-tuning design. And notice that today the list is well above 180. And again, you can go to our website and see the documentation. Now, this is typically where my peers stop when they talk about the anthropic principle, the idea that the universe reveals as evidence designed for the benefit of human beings. The truth is we see this evidence for design on all size scales. It's not just the universe. It turns out that we see overwhelming evidence for the design of our cluster of galaxies. We live in a unique cluster of galaxies that permits the existence of advanced life. And over 200 features of our Milky Way galaxy must be fine-tuned to make advanced life possible. And we need a just-right star. Thanks to the discovery of extrasolar planets, we now know that we need a just-right Jupiter and Saturn. In fact, all the planets play a critical role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth, now that we've demoted Pluto from the list. And we need a just-right Earth and a just-right Moon. Now, this allows us to develop a test. If there's no creator responsible for all this, we would anticipate that the more we learn about our Milky Way galaxy and other galaxies and our solar system and other planets, that the design evidence for the benefit of humanity would decrease in both strength and number, and the evidence for the biblical God as a designer would get progressively weaker and weaker as we learn more and more. But if we really are talking a creator, we would predict the exact opposite. Now, the advantage here is we only have one universe, but we got billions of galaxies, billions of stars, and billions of planets. And so we began doing this study back in 1995, and appropriately accounting for dependency factors, assuming a very generous limit to the maximum number of planets in the universe, we calculated a probability of less than one chance in 10 to the 31st power that one body would possess all 41 features with the just right values for life. This demonstrates how the evidence increases with respect to time for the God of the Bible. In 1995, 41 features. In 2006, 676 features. But look at the probabilities. Bottom line is, as astronomers learn more and more about our Milky Way galaxy and our planets, the evidence gets approximately a factor of a million times stronger every month, which means I can say to the skeptic, if you're not convinced today, wait 1 month. The evidence over the course of the past 25 years has been getting approximately a million times stronger each month. Freeman Dyson, an agnostic American physicist, put it this way: the more I examine the universe, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming. It was literally designed in advance for the appearance of human beings. Thank you.
So now we're going to hear the arguments from Professor Lewis Wolpert, who's going to present the counter-arguments.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not a physicist, and I cannot see in any meaningful, sensible way in which physics tells you anything about God. I mean, there was a thing that, you know, there's this dark energy. Why does that tell you that there's a God? And, sorry, the first thing any reasonable person would say, where did God come from and who created God? And the second point is that all these interesting things about physics don't really relate in any detailed way to what goes on in the Bible, but probably also relate to other religions. And can I remind you that Christianity is but one of many. There are probably about 20 major religions in the world. And can you please, if I could ask those of you who are committed Christians, what's the evidence that your religion is right and theirs is wrong? Because they would certainly say that yours is wrong and theirs is right. And I'll come to this question of belief in a moment. And can I remind you, not that you need reminding, that the Bible says that the universe was made in 7 days. I'm not a physicist, but it doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. May I remind you where women came from? Adam's rib. And there's a very nice cartoon in the New Yorker of a man walking with a lady and says, I've just thought of a different way of creating life. Sorry, not using a rib. Sorry, I don't. I can't resist that. So, there are so many things in the Bible that bear no relationship to what we understand about biology and the nature of science. And so, what I want to do, which you won't like one bit at all, is try and tell you why people are religious and where religion comes from. So, whereas the previous speaker has spoken about physics, I'm going to use evolution. And the point that, as I say, you're not going to like this, no matter. Can't like everything. But the really point is, first of all, let me remind you, as if you need reminding, that we humans have a basic need to construct beliefs to account for things that affect our lives. Let me give you a trivial thing. When you're ill and you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, he doesn't, or he or she says, they don't know what's wrong with you, you are really very upset. You can't bear not knowing what's wrong with you. And when the doctor does tell you what's wrong with you, I'll bet as you walk home or go home or are carried home, you will come up with some story as to why you got ill. You sat next to that person with a cough. You've been drinking and so forth and so on. We have an absolutely innate need to find causal explanations for things that affect our lives. And this really takes us back to the origins of religion. Because what makes us human and different from animals of all sorts, and people who work on animals can't stand this, is that we have a concept of physical cause and effect. Animals have a very poor understanding of physical causes and effect. If you offer a chimpanzee, you know, you have a set of rakes out there with the food, and only one of the rakes is touching the food, the chimpanzee won't know which rake to pull on. And there's a nice statement that seeing the wind blowing the fruit tree and the fruit falling off would persuade no animal to shake that branch. And what really makes us human is that we evolved concepts of cause and effect in relation to the physical world. And the reason we evolved those causes, the adaptive advantage, was it led to tool making. I want to tell you, we are the tool making animal. Yes, I know there are animals that break, you know, chimpanzees that break nuts or stones, but it's very, very limited, their skills. And I know that they can put little branches into the tree to get out a few nuts, but basically they don't do much. And human beings evolved a concept of cause and effect which had the advantage that they could make tools. You cannot make tools unless you have a concept of physical cause and effect. And once they had done this, and personally it was a great advantage to have tools, and incidentally not everyone believes this. I've got Robin Dunbar believes that the real thing in evolution was not tool making, but cooperation between human beings. So let me ask you a question. If you were going to go into the jungle, what would you rather take with you, a colleague or an axe. I hope you take an axe. Be much more sensible, may I say. And also, once human beings evolved concepts of cause and effect and relation to tools, they began to want to understand the cause and effect of things that affected their life, like illness, particularly illness. And the one cause they knew very well was human causes, because they knew what they could do themselves, and that's the origin of gods. They invented god-like human beings, which could account for things which they couldn't find an explanation for. And this is, I believe, the origin of religion, because first of all, it provided explanations, and secondly, it provided a means for trying to appease the gods and to pray for the gods. And can I just remind you that people who are religious are healthier on the whole than those who are not religious. You know, you do better if you have. There were also religious communities, which are a good thing. Now, I think that was adaptive. And because it was adaptive, those people who evolved these beliefs survived better, and therefore we all have in our minds a basic set of religious beliefs. We have a mystical mind. I'm sorry to tell you that you all have mystical minds. Yes, you've made me under control, but nevertheless you do. And can I just remind you, if I can find my quotation, do you remember with Timothy Leary? Timothy Leary, where is he? Sorry. Timothy Leary, I don't know, anyhow, I'll make it up. I know more or less what he said. Timothy Leary took LSD. And now you really want me to read the darn thing. Hold on a second. Here we are, I've got it. I discovered that beauty, revelation, sensuality, the cellular history of the past, God, the devil, all lie inside my body, outside my mind. This simple little silly molecule of LSD did that. That can only be because these sort of ideas were in our mind. And there is evidence that if you give someone one of the molecules from magic mushrooms, they have mystical experiences. And you can even get, if you put certain electric currents into people's brains, they have religious experiences. I claim we do have a mystical mind. And paranormal experiences are not that uncommon in the general population. And the percentage of people in the world who are religious, it's about 40% nowadays, more 40 to 50%. That's an awful lot of people. And I keep reminding you that Christianity is just but one of many religions. And the evidence that physics provides evidence from the Bible just seems to me certainly with no evidence. So what I would really like is some direct evidence for the existence of God. And also I want to know where God came from. Because if you're going to have God creating the universe, you also got to have someone creating, or some, not someone, something creating God. And I just don't see where this is. And so I think that one can get on perfectly well with recognizing that we don't need to have these mystical beliefs anymore, although I have to say I am not against religion, provided it doesn't interfere, like saying we mustn't have contraception and so forth. I think religion helps a great number of people to survive. It gives them someone to pray to, and on the whole, it can be very helpful to them. Where I'm totally against it is when they begin to interfere and try to impose their ideas on the public in general. So, let me say, I don't think physics gives us a clue as to the existence of God or the Bible being valid, and I think the best way to think about religion is from an evolutionary point of view. Thank you.
Okay. If we could have some quiet now, we're going to open up a period of discussion between Dr. Hugh Ross and Professor Lewis Wolpert. Professor Lewis, if you would like to ask the first question.
Yes, it's quite a simple question, really. I'd like to know, what's your best bit of evidence for the existence of God?
Well, that's what I tried to do in my talk tonight. You asked me a question during the talk repeatedly. Who created God?
Yes.
Would you like me to try to answer that?
Yes, it would be lovely, yes.
Well, you notice I spent some time on the space-time theorem, so it proves there's actual beginning to cosmic time. It also establishes that cosmic time is linear, and cosmic time can't be stopped or reversed. In such a concept of time, everything must have a beginning or a creation event with a causal agent that is so constrained. But the causal agent that created time is not constrained to linear time. Notice that cause and effect is taking place independent of cosmic time, which means for the cosmic creator, he must have access to at least the equivalent of two dimensions of time, not one dimension of time. And if time is two-dimensional, with a length of time and a width of time, you can have an infinite number of timelines running in an infinite number of directions. So if you place cosmic time over here, we could have God dwelling on another timeline that's infinitely long that never crosses or touches our timeline, as such that being would have no beginning, no ending, would be uncreated. And what I notice about the holy books or religions of the world, only the Bible says of God, no beginning, no ending, and uncreated. It's also the only holy book that says that God can arbitrarily compress time or expand time. A day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. Mathematically, that can only happen in two or more dimensions of time. So yeah, we have to be created. We need a causal agent, but the creator of the universe doesn't need a causal agent. He's an uncreated entity because he's not constrained by time. Obviously, the space-time theorem is established. He can create any number of space-time dimensions at will.
I don't really understand the physics, but that doesn't provide evidence for the existence of God.
It does provide evidence for an agent beyond space and time that created matter, energy, space, and time, and that is a standard dictionary definition of God.
Does the Big Bang not help at all? Yeah?
The Big Bang helps tremendously because... what I tried to say in my talk is the Bible... I mean, we talk about all these different religions, and you're asking the question, why Christianity? Well, what I noticed as a young astronomy student, the other holy books got the cosmology dead wrong. The Bible got it right, and it predicted accurately future scientific discoveries thousands of years ahead of its time. The fact that the Bible has demonstrated predictive power means it can't come from a human source.
Just give me the best example of a prediction.
Well, there's multiple predictions.
Just give me one, the best one.
Okay, how the Bible predicted that we live in a universe that continuously expands over its entire history. No other man said that until the 20th century.
So
the Bible stood alone. Yeah, go ahead.
Let you ask a question, Professor Lewis, and then we'll get back to this.
Well, I'm curious as to why you think there is no scientific evidence for God. I mean, people have been writing about this for centuries.
Yes, and they want to believe it.
Well, I mean, where's the evidence for the non-existence of God?
No, you can't say the evidence for the non-existence of God is the absence of evidence.
Well, there are times where the absence of evidence is absence for evidence. I mean, a good example of that would be the origin of life.
Yes.
Where we recognize that Earth never had prebiotics. We know why it never had prebiotics. The physics of the Earth would forbid the development of prebiotics on the early Earth. We also know the origin of life happened in a geologic instant of time. You've got no time, and you've got no prebiotics, you've got no naturalistic explanation for the origin of life.
Well, the origin of life is still an unsolved problem. I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, the origin of the first cell.
Well, it's more than an unsolved problem. If you don't have prebiotics, you don't have a naturalistic solution.
Well, I think there are, you know, without going through the details, which I'm not all that familiar with, about the origin of life, there are very complex models which people are working on for the origin of the first cell. It's really quite difficult. There's no problem about getting proteins and DNA, but to get a cell is something really quite difficult.
Yes, and I would agree that chemists have made amazing advances
Absolutely.
In trying to develop this. But notice it's an intelligent chemist, well-funded, with a laboratory that's actually putting together
Absolutely.
Some of the... I mean,
And to claim this happened in nature without the benefit of the prebiotics, because notice that these chemists, they have the building blocks. They're putting the building blocks together. But what we're seeing on the early Earth is no building blocks. If you've got no building blocks, how can you put anything together?
Well, but I think from the early Earth, you could certainly have proteins.
But no, the evidence is showing us, and it's all based on isotopic evidence, how, you know, the isotopes tell us the Earth has postbiotics but no prebiotics. Mm. Prebiotics, you get a different carbon-12 to carbon-13 signature. We also know from physics that you can't get prebiotics, because if you got oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere, that stops the prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, ultraviolet radiation comes through unimpeded, and that stops the biochemistry.
Perhaps
so you're stuck with oxygen. Yeah, go ahead.
Both of you, just because I'm a physicist, not a biologist, to briefly explain what a prebiotic and a postbiotic is for the benefit of everyone sat up there who's
including
following
me.
This. Yeah, if we could explain briefly what a prebiotic and a postbiotic is.
Okay, a postbiotic would simply be the decay products of once-living organisms. Prebiotics are the same kinds of molecules that could be assembled together to make a living organism. But the difference is you get isotope ratios of sulfur, nitrogen, and carbon that distinguish the prebiotics from the postbiotics. And so we have evidence that we see the postbiotic signatures but not the prebiotic. And I think what you'd enjoy as a physicist, we know why, is that if you've got oxygen, that's going to prevent the prebiotic chemistry from even getting off the ground. But if you don't have oxygen, nothing stops the ultraviolet radiation. And ultraviolet radiation is just as catastrophic to prebiotic chemistry.
But when we come to biology, what about the creation of the first woman from Adam's rib? Must I take that seriously?
Well, you need to read it carefully in the text. What it says is that God took something from Adam's side.
Yes.
I kind of interpret that as a biopsy. So he took a biopsy from Adam's side. I don't think he was crippled by the operation. And that biopsy would have given God a DNA template. And so I see two ways, according to the Bible, that God creates a new life form. He can create it from the dust of the earth like he did Adam, or he can take a template from another creature and re-engineer the DNA to create a different species.
Yes, but the whole trouble with creating Adam is that we know that Adam wasn't just suddenly created. We know that human beings evolved, unless you're against evolution.
Well, what I notice in the evolution of mammals is there's been four papers published showing that if you have a mammal that has an adult body size bigger than 7 pounds, it will go extinct before it experiences significant evolution. And the problem with the primates, they're all bigger than 7 pounds. And the thing we see is that if you look at Homo erectus, they've been around for 1.8 million years. But the skeletons we see of the most ancient Homo erecti are no different from the most recent. We can't see any evolution in the bone morphology. With Neanderthal, we got both bones and DNA. But likewise, over an 80,000-year period, we can't measure any change in either the morphology or the DNA. We see the same thing with human beings. And therefore, it confirms the 7-pound limit, that these are creatures that are sufficiently large
but
and complex.
But nevertheless, human beings, certainly you don't deny that human beings evolved from more primitive animals.
Well, I'm arguing that you certainly see a history of life over the past 3.8 billion years that progresses from simple to complex.
Sure.
But it's not by natural process alone.
Well, but hold on. But when God created Adam, just boom like that, you know, in 20 minutes, this shows that the Bible is talking nonsense.
Well, I noticed you made that comment about the fact that it's nonsense to believe that God created the universe and everything in it in 7 days. And people often ask me in the church, Hugh, do you believe that God created in 7 literal days? I say, yes, I do, but keep in mind that Hebrew is a very tiny vocabulary size, such that almost every biblical Hebrew now has multiple literal definitions. So when it comes to the word day, it can mean part of the daylight hours, all the daylight hours, a 24-hour period, or a long but finite period of time. And there are 27 chapter-length or longer creation texts in the Bible. And when you compare all of them, it's clear that if you go with a 24-hour day interpretation, the Bible self-contradicts. If you go with six consecutive long periods of time for God's creation activity, then the entire Bible can be read both literally and consistently. So I'm a day-age creationist, and I believe the Bible literally teaches a day-age creation. I think the 24-hour people simply haven't read their Bible correctly.
I understand. But do you believe in evolution?
If we could let Hugh ask the question.
Sorry.
Well, this is a good discussion. I don't mind continuing like this.
Do you believe
he's got lots of questions.
I'm not needed. I'll just
do you think that evolution is based upon God designing the next step in evolution?
Well, I think with evolution and creation, we have to be careful about the definitions. When you talk to me as an astronomer, do you believe in evolution? I think of stars. You know, stars are forming, they burn, they end up. Sure. And I believe that stars are such simple systems that we can explain the entire history of star burning naturalistically. We have the math. We've got the observations that demonstrate it. But keep in mind, stars are orders of magnitude simpler than living organisms. When it comes to living organisms, I don't think you can explain the whole story naturalistically. I mean, I've just made you the example. What about the primates? We're not observing any change, any significant change in either DNA or the morphology. So my position is that God supernaturally intervened and separately created a dozen plus species of bipedal primates, including our own species, Homo sapiens sapiens. And we have a book on this. You can get a book from us. I think it's on the table here. Who is Adam? Where we kind of document the DNA and morphology evidence that establishes this. And, you know, I think you're probably familiar with Ian Tattersall's work.
Certainly not.
Well, he's one of the, he's an atheist, but he's one of the leading researchers in terms of physical anthropology. And he's the one that's well known for documenting that when you get human beings, there are these immediate cultural big bangs. It's something you talked about, the tools.
Sure.
And what we notice, I mean, you made a great point. The chimpanzees and Neanderthals, they have tools, but they're primitive and they don't advance.
They don't.
I mean, what they have at the end is the same as what they had at the beginning.
Yeah.
Humans is different. As soon as humans show up, there's an explosion of technology and it advances generation to generation. And we see that with clothing, we see that with jewelry, art, music, you mentioned religious expression. I think this documents that we human beings are unique amongst all the animals on the face of the earth.
No question.
Well, I mean, that's your third origin of life. And this is something I found interesting about the Bible compared to other holy books. The Bible speaks about three separate origins of life. Life is purely physical. Life is physical and soulish, a reference to birds and mammals, where they can relate to one another and nurture one another, and then one and only one species, its body, soul, and spirit. And I think you made a good point, too, about the brain. We can do experiments on the brain and actually stimulate religious experiences.
No question.
But that tells me that the brain is an interface with the spirit of the man.
Yes,
and you can mess up the interface, just like you can mess up the interface
of your computer. Do you think there are any miracles? I mean, since God did this all rather a long time ago, has he or she done anything more since then?
Well, something that impressed me when I was 17 reading the Bible for the first time is that it speaks of God creating for 6 days and resting on the seventh day. And one reason I believe that these can't be 24-hour days is when it comes to the seventh day, there's no evening and morning. And several passages of the Bible speak about the seventh day as an ongoing event through the present into the future. It's that period of time when God ceases from his creative work and focuses on targeting the problem of evil. And so as a scientist, I'm not expecting to find evidence for supernatural intervention in real time. I am expecting it in the 6 days. And I think this explains why so many of us astronomers believe in God. And so few biologists do, because almost all the data that comes to us in astronomy comes from before the existence of human beings, whereas after human beings, God's at rest. And so the biologist is doing research in real time. All he's going to find is natural causation. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he rests. Now, I would also agree that God's miracles from the Christian perspective are not limited to science. I mean, for 6 days, God is working in the scientific realm. On the seventh day, he ceases that. We would expect him to be performing miracles that would be targeting the problem of evil. And this is kind of what you see in the gospel accounts, the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. I would argue if you want to see something in real time, look at the book of Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel contains over 100 predictions of what we would expect to see in the rebirth of the nation of Israel for a second time. And you and I are old enough to actually be witnesses to the fulfillment of all the prophecies in the book of Ezekiel concerning the modern nation Israel. So I think we could target that and say, you know, that's clearly evidence, again, that the Bible has predictive power. If it's got predictive power, if it's never wrong in what it says about history and science, then this can't be from a mere human source. It's got to be from the one that created matter, energy, space, and time.
So perhaps you'd like to ask a question of Professor Lewis, because I'm conscious that we're exploring your arguments very heavily. But
right. Well, as I said, I'm comfortable with that. You know, I've done debates before with atheist scientists. In fact, I was going to tell people about this debate we did at Caltech in front of the Skeptic Society. And this is where Victor Stenger, the particle physicist, had an exchange with me. But what I noticed about Victor Stenger, he really tried to present some positive evidence for his atheism. And also, he agreed with me that it's not fair for an atheist just to point holes in the weaknesses of Christians' arguments. You know, I would admit, I mean, I'm not a good debater when it comes to defending the existence of God. You know, God obviously can defend himself.
Well, when did you last do that?
Well, the question I want to ask you is, can you do something like Victor Stenger did, try to provide some scientific evidence to prove that God doesn't exist?
No. To prove the evidence that God doesn't exist. That's very difficult. No. I think when you go to science, you've got to provide evidence that God does exist. You can't go around finding evidence that God does not exist. You see, if I tell you that I have seen a fish in the South African waters that speaks very good Afrikaans, and you ask me, could I please provide you with evidence that this does not exist, then it's ridiculous. You can't.
Well, I mean, I do appreciate that Victor Stenger really did try to make a positive case. He made the point that, the universe seems hostile to life everywhere. Why would God constrain humanity to just one little planet? And so he tried to argue that God is not all-powerful and all-loving, or the Christians have got it wrong about their God, because, after all, we're constrained to a small place. But I think from God's perspective, he would just look at humanity as being immature. And when I read in the Bible, God will one day deliver us to an unlimitless or a limitless habitat space. But at least we're having an exchange on this basis. And also what I appreciated about Victor Stenger, he said, you know, science is an effective tool to testing the belief or the non-belief in the existence of God. And I tried to do a little bit of that in my talk. You know, if there is no God behind all this science, we should expect science to progress according to a certain pattern. And if what I'm saying is true, it should go in the opposite direction. Let's let the science run for a few months and see which side gains the evidence. So in that sense, I think you really can argue scientifically for an atheistic worldview. But what I'm seeing is in the scientific literature, it's not going in the direction that favors atheism. It's going in the opposite direction.
Maybe that's in physics and biology not.
Pardon me?
It's certainly not true of biology.
Well, I think it is true in biology. I mean, you know, kind of what I'm seeing is, number one, there is no naturalistic explanation of the origin of life. And number two, in biology...
Oh, no, there are explanations. They just haven't been established.
Well, what we have established is it takes somebody a lot more brilliant than the biochemist in Craig Venter's lab to pull
yes,
it off.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's true. And these are tough problems.
Well... But yeah, if you measure it to be tougher than the ability of Craig Venter's biochemist, then that certainly would rule out the dirt of the Earth 3.8 billion years ago pulling it off.
No, certainly.
As I said, no prebiotics, no time, no naturalistic solution.
No, biology is really quite weird, because when the cell actually evolved, the cell is really so complicated that all sorts of strange things came about.
Well, I would agree with that, but keep in mind you already got something that's alive. Once you've got something that's alive,
sure,
there's a lot more causal capability.
Sure.
But I mean, what I'm talking about is going from something that has no life at all.
I know.
Just the physics and the chemistry.
Well, hold on. Do you think God has life?
Yes.
Ooh. Not cells.
Well, what the Bible tells us about God is that he is an immaterial being. He doesn't have a body. He is capable of creating dimensions at will, physics at will.
But don't you find that a bit surprising, since he's got no body and yet can do all this creating?
It doesn't surprise me at all, because the space-time theorems tell us there's a causal agent that's able to create matter, energy, space, and time. It would make sense to me that a causal agent is independent of matter, energy, space, and time. It's got to be.
Do either of you have any further questions for each other? I sort of feel like I'm in a tennis match and everyone's going backwards and forwards.
Well, I heard your comment about, what makes you think your religion is right and every other religion is wrong.
Yes.
You know, and I made the comment that, when I looked at the other religions, they got the science wrong.
Yes.
Hinduism, for example, says that we live in a reincarnating universe with a cycle of 4.32 billion years. We know the number is wrong. We also know the reincarnation concept has got to be wrong. The universe has way too much entropy for that to be a possibility. I saw that at age 17 and said, gosh, Hinduism's not the way I'm going to go. And I looked at the Quran, and it tells about the stars being closer to us than the planets. I said, well, we know that's not right. But when I picked up the Bible, I spent 18 months trying to find a provable scientific error. Couldn't find any. But instead, I found over 200 places in the Bible where it accurately predicted future scientific discovery, sometimes thousands of years in advance of the scientific discovery. You know, even predicting something in the book of Job, the oldest book of the Bible, tells us that darkness, cosmic darkness, is a substance. When I was a student, I was taught that darkness on a cosmic scale is simply the absence of light. Now we know it's an actual substance. The Bible also tells us that this cosmic darkness has specific locations in the universe. We now know that to be true. Well, you know, here's an example of the most ancient book in the Bible getting the physics right thousands of years ahead of its time.
Do other physicists agree with you? There must be physicists who say you're talking nonsense.
Well, what I notice about the history of Big Bang cosmology is that for 60 years, physicists and astronomers did everything they could to get away from Big Bang cosmology. Why? Because they recognized it implied the God of the Bible. They said, we can't have that. We've got to find some way around this. It explains Fred Hoyle's invention of the steady state model. It explains the oscillating universe, the hesitating universe. But eventually the observational evidence for Big Bang cosmology became so overwhelming that the atheist Jeffrey Burbidge said, well, all right, my colleagues are rushing off to join the First Church of Christ of the Big Bang, but it looks like the evidence can't be denied. And I noticed when I went to the Soviet Union back in the 1980s, I ran into physicists and astronomers who were forbidden by the communist government to talk about the Big Bang to lay people. Really? And it's because they realized it implied the Christian faith. And so they said, look, this is an atheistic nation. You're not going to be allowed to talk about Big Bang cosmology. So I think the Big Bang, as I mentioned in my talk, was predicted in the Bible thousands of years ahead of time. And that had a huge impact on me as a young man in persuading me that this Bible indeed must come from the one that knows the physics of the universe.
So I think at this point, if we could open it up to some questions from the floor. If, when you do ask your question, you could just give your name and direct it to either one, the other, or both of the the people we've got here tonight. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask?
My name's Edward Goldman. I suppose I'm a physicist, really, and that's what I did here a long time ago. And it'll take me a minute, I'm sorry, to put this question, but I feel it very really, that you use the Bible as a very precise tool with which to match against the universe as I write and find that the Bible is actually predicting correctly the way the universe is. Makes me think that the only logical position you have then is that the Bible is transmitted by God through to humans, and that we have this book which represents God's writing, not man's writing. But the oldest copy that we have of the New Testament, I think it's something like about 400 AD, and the oldest copy of the Old Testament is about 200 or 300 BC. And it's been rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, presumably by people in your sense. I mean, I think it's by people. And so when the Jews were taken by Nebuchadnezzar and were existing, I mean, I read the Bible quite a lot, and I find the romanticism of the part to do with being by the waters of Babylon really easy for me to interpret. These are the people who were carried away from the land of milk and honey and are now slaves. And they are writing about their memories of what their grandfather's memories was of this time. And I see it there and I feel it. So I can't avoid the idea that this book is actually an evolving story written by the people, rewritten by the people, rewritten by the people, and written again. I mean, just think of what happened at Nicaea, which bits of the New Testament were and weren't included in, translated from one language, etc. I'm going on a bit, but I mean, sure. I think the question is really important for you to answer to me, because you're taking some words and trying to say the Hebrew root for this could mean 24 hours, or could mean this, but this other word means it's through all space and all time. But when Abraham or whoever it was kind of wrote the original Bible in whatever language it probably wasn't Hebrew. Who knows quite what it means? I mean, I'll just say one more bit in this chart, because I argue about it, you know. It says in the several times in Exodus, God says to Moses, you know, thou shalt not kill. That's one of the Ten Commandments. Just think about what that word kill could mean. If instead it had been, you shall not take life, well, that would mean something. If you shall not kind of destroy life, it means you can't even be a vegetarian, you can only eat dead things. So this business of picking a particular word and reading a very precise scientific meaning into it feels to me intellectually shoddy.
So, to paraphrase that, you're suggesting that because the Bible is written by humans and has been translated and rewritten and is constantly evolving, to use it as a tool for prediction would be imprecise, particularly when the Hebrew words have so many meanings and can be so diverse, and asking how we can use it as a tool for prediction.
Yeah, no, I like your question. And there's been a lot written on your very question. It's kind of the documentary evidence for the Bible and how can we trust the reliability of what's been given to us. You made reference to the fact that the oldest copy of the Old Testament is 2nd century B.C., Dead Sea Scrolls, and that was a discovery made in our lifetime. But what impressed the Hebrew scholars is when they compared that 2nd century B.C. document to the most recent other document we had, the 9th century AD Masoretic text, they found it was virtually identical. 11 centuries separating these two documents and no change that we can see.
Do you see that the Almighty is a caretaker of these words? So they come to you in order that you can make these predictions accurately because he has cared.
That's kind of what I'm saying, is that we have evidence that there must have been some caretaking of the trustworthiness of the text. And you know, part of what we now understand is a reason why the transmission's been so accurate from the past, because when these Hebrew scribes would make copies of the Tanakh, the Old Testament, there would be a scribe making a copy, and there would be four scribes, two in either shoulder, watching the copy that he was making. And every time the scribe made a mistake, the mistake was recorded in the margin. The other four scholars would initial it that they had seen this mistake, and they corrected it. And so that explains why we have such a faithful transmission of the Old Testament. Now, in terms of the New Testament, there wasn't quite the care with respect to making copies that the Hebrews would exercise in the Old Testament. But the difference is we have tens of thousands of manuscripts.
If we could just...
Copying accurately is what I'm asking you to talk about. I'm asking you to talk about where the words actually come from.
Okay, that's your second question. I mean, exactly to what degree can we trust the definitions of the words? Well, you can pick up what's called the Hebrew lexicon, which is basically a dictionary of the Hebrew words. And, you know, there are very good ones today which actually show you not only the definitions of the Hebrew words at the time that they were recorded in the biblical text, but how those definitions changed over the centuries. And so you can use that to evaluate the degree to which you can trust the definitions of the words. And this, I think, is helped by the fact that you have overlapping passages that deal with this creation theology. So you're not stuck just looking at Genesis 1. There are three other biblical texts that also take you through the content of the six creation days. And so what I tell Christians in churches, it's not enough to take the Bible literally. We have to take it literally and consistently. It's just like science. We want to make sure our biology and our chemistry and physics match because we believe we live in a consistent universe. We live in a universe where science is possible. Well, in terms of the Bible, we have 66 books of the Bible, and the overlap allows us to develop a consistent theology.
Okay, so there's a few more questions in the room. Someone at the back there had their hand up. Yeah?
I'm interested in physics. I was wondering what the Bible has anything to do with the common microwave background temperature, and that predicts numerical values. And also, a side note, I think Joss made it more from Lewis Walker.
Yes. So the question there was, what does the Bible do to actually predict the figures of cosmic microwave background radiation?
Well, it's telling us that the universe has a space-time beginning, that it continuously expands from that beginning under constant laws of physics, or one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. This is the principle of thermodynamics. That if you have an expanding system, the temperature goes down. If you've got a compressing system, the temperature goes up. That's how the pistons in your car engine work. When the piston chamber compresses, the temperature goes up. So if you've got a continuously expanding universe, that's a universe that must get colder and colder according to the laws of thermodynamics. So once you know the age of the universe, you can develop a biblically predicted cooling curve, and you can test that biblically cooling curve by measurements. Now, how do we do the measurements? We look at the spectral lines, particularly...
Was less to do with how we predict the cosmic microwave background radiation and get the data for it here, but rather how you get the curve from the Bible itself.
I mean, how do we get...
The curve.
Numerical values, the data points and error bars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how do we make those actual measurements? Yeah, what we do...
The question might be, where's the equation in the Bible?
Well, I thought I answered that by saying the equation you get from the Bible is first, there's a space-time beginning. The universe continuously expands from that beginning under a constant law of thermodynamics, which means that according to the laws of thermodynamics, the universe must get colder and colder, and it gets colder and colder at a numerically predicted rate. And so we can use that numerically predicted rate and literally put the Bible's claims about cosmology to the test.
Okay, so if I could have questions for Professor Lewis Wolpert. Has anyone got... There we go.
About the evolution, how do you explain that the human being is the last... You know, can we have a species that is more evolved than human?
I can't really hear what you're saying.
So I think the question is, how do we explain that we have we don't have a species that is more evolved than human beings? So if evolution is continuing,
evolution is continuing, and human evolution will continue.
So there are going to be species more advanced than humans.
She's asking whether there will be species more advanced than humans.
I just don't know. Given time, I think it's a bit unlikely. In order to get major changes in animals related to humans, you know, with big, large brains and things like that. I think it's a bit unlikely. But certainly human evolution will continue. If you come back in 5 million years' time, you might find all sorts of strange things around.
And if I could ask the guy in the black T-shirts have his hand up for a while.
I've got a question for Lewis. I was a bit surprised at one point that you made the argument that absence of evidence is evidence of absence. Because from my understanding, it's actually a logical fallacy to do that. Because if I give you an example, I don't have any evidence that there's a person standing out there in that hallway on the other side of the wall.
No.
But that might be because they're not there, but it might be there, but there's a big wall in the way. So that's the problem, I think, that comes with saying absence of evidence is evidence of absence. It just tells you, well, I don't have the evidence in my possession. So I'm wondering why you use that argument. But on top of that, I'd like a bit more detail into why you actually don't think Hugh has any evidence, because you did give detail about perhaps reasons why people come to believe in God, and you dealt with, you addressed the secondary question of, well, where did God come from? But unless I missed something, which I might have done, I didn't really hear, I think, any counter-arguments to the specific evidence that you presented from astronomy in the Bible. So I'd just like a little bit more on that. So do you defend that absence of evidence is evidence of absence? And why is there an absence of evidence with Hugh's arguments?
Well, I find the physics hard to follow. I'm just not a good enough physicist to decide whether that's reliable evidence. And my guess is that if I did, I would certainly decide it was no evidence for God whatsoever.
Perhaps you could expand a little bit more on absence for evidence being evidence for absence.
Yeah, that's not absence, but if you're looking for something that really is so extraordinary as God creating the universe, you want, like, some evidence for the existence of God. I would like something that God's done recently. You know, what has God done in the last, 10, 20,000 years? You know, doesn't seem to be acting particularly strongly at the moment.
Fulfilled his promise to Israel.
We don't know yet.
Well, no. The promise.
There's plenty of questions in the room, so if we could try and get through as many as possible. Maybe another one for Professor Lewis. Yes.
First of all, I'm an evolutionary biologist, by the way.
Oh, good.
But I would like to question about cosmology, though, or the beginnings, and that is, what is what would philosophically be called first cause? In other words, do you believe that matter and energy have always existed? And related to that, where do you believe the laws of the universe came from? Because they presumably needed to be in existence before the beginning.
Now, I cannot answer that. That's a physics question. That's yours. Because you've
got a logical sequence all the way through the dawn of life, etc., and you can't, okay, the origin of life is a difficult one, but you can't answer the logical question at the beginning.
I can't.
Can you explain?
No, I can't. Anything? I can't. It's just always been there. That's just the nature of the universe.
So therefore, you haven't really explained anything.
Well, it depends what you're trying to explain. The origin of cells is not dependent upon that.
But in terms of life, the universe and everything, in any set of arguments, if you can provide part of the chain of argument, that's interesting, but you need to have the whole chain of argument, presumably, so you have got a convincing argument.
Well, that's what the physicists are offering, and I have no idea whether they're right.
Okay,
I guess if they're wrong.
Perhaps we can take another question. Right at the back there, yeah.
I have a question for our first speaker, if I may. And I'd just like to know what your response is to a problem I have with what I think was quite a large thrust in your argument, which is quite, you know, nicely demonstrated by your quote out there. You talk a lot about how the universe is perfect for us and how all the conditions are so finely tuned to 10 to the zillion, trillion, quadrillion, you know, probability one, basically, or probability zero, that it was not designed, etc., etc. I think that you're looking at it from perhaps the wrong direction, and I can see why. I'm the first person to admit that I'm a very arrogant individual, and as such, I can quite understand why, as humanity, as a race, we're very eager to take ourselves as being at the centre of everything. What you're essentially saying is that the universe is perfect for us. I think you're wrong. I think we're perfect for the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
We are here because the universe is like that. If it were different,
we wouldn't
there would be something else. Yeah. And, you know, there would...
Very good.
Okay, so to paraphrase, the question is, how is the universe perfect for us? Is it not us, we, that are perfect for the universe?
Sure.
Well, I would get your point if we came first. Then you could argue that the universe is perfect for us, but the point is the universe predates us human beings.
Yes, that's I think
fundamentally he's asking if we weren't in existence, because the universe hadn't had this very precise alignment and fine-tuning, then we wouldn't even know about it because we wouldn't be here. So,
okay, I think you're making a philosophical point that Richard Swinburne here in Britain answered about 20 years ago. You may be familiar with the argument. He said, you know, you could have a person condemned to death by the firing squad and 10 people point the rifles at him in an attempt to do with his life. He survives the event and says, well, of course, I wouldn't be here unless they all missed. Richard Swinburne's argument is you need an explanation for why they all miss. If you got 10 sharpshooters with rifles intending to kill that individual, he would be dead. And so he concluded that the evidence that the individual survived indicates that there's somebody that wanted that individual to survive. Either the sharpshooters were given blanks in their guns or they intended that he would survive and they purposely missed. And likewise, he concludes that the argument we're here because we're here is philosophical nonsense. The fact is that to say that we're here because we wouldn't be here unless the universe had all these characteristics misses the point that the universe was purposed in order to allow us to exist. Now, something that came up in the debate I had with Victor Stenger, he says, well, what about other life forms? You're only talking about life as we know it. Well, that too is part of Christian theology, that God was not content to just make one-dimensional realm. He made a separate realm for the angelic host. Different physics, different dimensionality, but it's a different species of life. And Victor Stenger did admit that if we're talking human beings, then yes, the universe is uniquely designed and exquisitely designed to make our existence possible. So that's the one point where we agree. But you can watch the debate and see.
If I could take the question from this guy here.
Sorry, yeah. I think part of the point he was trying to make, and I thought he made very well, was the idea that the universe must exist the way it does in order for us to be here at all. But on top of that, the argument you had is based around the word, the concept of fine-tuning, which I think is a really leading concept, because you're stating within that word that you think, like, that, you know, this divine being has got whatever, had this active component of tampering with the universe. And it seems like a bit of an intellectual stretch to go from the fact that just because there's this improbability, the fact that, you know, the universe must be the way it is in order for us to be here. But if you look at it in terms of fine-tuning, To take that and to call that evidence for the existence and actions of a God that, I mean, conveniently lives in a place outside every parameter that we have to observe the world around us, and that spoke to primitive humans 2,000 years ago, but not to us now. Why is that, you know, fine-tuning the logical conclusion? I mean, surely you could attribute anything at all, to a being that is that vague.
Well, it's not vague. I mean, the Bible is very precise in what it states about what the record of nature should look like. And this is just one example of hundreds of places where you can put the Bible to the test. I mean, that was part of my story. I looked at the other holy books of the religions first, and what I noticed was they did very poorly on trying to predict what kind of universe and history of life we would find in the universe. The Bible was radically different. It got it right on every point. And got it right in considerable detail. These are not vague statements that you find in the Bible. They're precise statements.
Yeah, but the concept of God himself in the Christian religion is vague, because every time you come up with, you know, you're saying you need to prove the non-existence of God, or you need proof of the existence of God, you cannot prove God, because Christians have, since the dawn of Christianity, placed God in a level which is outside of everything that is tangible to us. I mean, obviously it wasn't 2,000 years ago, and somehow that's changed, and that seems a little odd.
I think you may be misunderstanding the biblical claim. Yes, the Bible does claim that God is totally transcendent to his created realm. That's where the Christianity would agree with Islam. But where we would disagree with Islam is that God is not only transcendent, he is immanent. He fills the entirety of his creation. So everywhere within the creation, God exists and God acts. So it's not just a God that's outside, it's a God that's inside as well.
Okay. If we could just limit the follow-ups to one question, just because I'm conscious that a lot of people have questions in this room. Did you have a question for Professor Lewis by any chance? Oh, both. Great. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask, do you not think everyone could benefit from religions, all religions being modernized?
Yeah, so do you think that everyone globally could benefit from religions being modernized?
I think as long as religions keep to themselves and don't interfere with other people's lives, I think they can be very helpful to people. You know, because they give them a set of beliefs that makes them feel better. The fact that they're based on false evidence doesn't really matter.
Okay, well, the thing that attracted me about Christianity, one of the things is it's the one religion that thrives in a free market exchange of ideas. I mean, what I found in the other religions is this idea that they need to legislate people's beliefs, whereas in Christianity, there's a freedom to choose and investigate and put to the test. As Paul puts it, everything must be tested. Hold fast to that which is good. And when people reacted and said in the early church, what should we do about the pagan temples? He says, leave them alone. Let them practice their religious beliefs.
But hold on, I'm confused. But in Christianity, there are lots of different religions with very different ideas. How do you explain that?
Well, again, that's part of the free market concept of Christianity. We're not worried about competition for other religions. We believe that the truth will speak for itself. So let people practice their religious beliefs, and may the best model, the best religion, win. We don't have to legislate Christianity in this nation. We can say we have religious freedom. And the Christians are the ones that have always promoted religious freedom, and that's because they...
Okay, so there was a question from the guy in the blue right at the back. Okay, I'm trying to note down people as they put their hands up. So the question for both speakers is, we're talking a lot about God not intervening after he created the universe, but what do you both make of the claim that Jesus was...
Jesus claims to be God,
the Son of God. Jesus claims to be God, the Son of God. Yeah, so what do you both make of that?
I think it's a terrific story. But the idea of being dead and then being taken up to heaven is just a myth and bears no relationship to reality whatsoever. But it's an extremely attractive myth and has done a lot of good to a lot of people. But the evidence for that sort of thing is simply false.
Yeah, and just to clarify, when I stated that God is not intervening now, I meant God is not intervening in physical creation activity. He has rested from his work of physical creation activity the moment he created Eve. But it doesn't mean that God is inactive. And I think you gave a good example. 2,000 years ago, the creator of the universe humbled himself and became a human being, lived a life amongst us, demonstrated his moral perfection. Even his mother and his brothers and sisters couldn't accuse him of any moral imperfection. And then he willingly chose to die on a cross in order to make the offer of trading his moral perfection for our moral imperfection. I don't see this as a myth. I mean, when you look at the historical evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead, it's historically unassailable. I mean, if the Romans wanted to put a stop to Christianity, which they really did, all they had to do is produce the body. Likewise, if the Jews wanted to put an end to Christianity, which they really wanted to do, all they had to do is produce the body. Nobody could produce the body.
And, okay. So I have two questions on that side, two in the center, yes, you in the blue, and one over that side. So we'll go from this side.
My question is for Professor Wolfe. You said two things were innate to the brain. One was kind of mysticism, and the other was rationality.
I didn't say rationality.
Well, you said we evolved rationality.
No, we evolved causal beliefs.
Okay, so my question is, why should we trust that idea of causal beliefs, which is essential to science, and not the mystical part of our brain that you said was innate to us? Why?
Because the causal belief enables us to make tools, which enables us to survive. The mystical one really leads us to religion, which can be a little helpful, but the causal one actually is what made human beings evolve in the way that we did. Because tool making was absolutely essential for our evolution.
Okay, so if I could take your question. Do you have your hand up, the lady in the white shirt?
Oh. I suppose it wasn't a question. The reason I was going full was because, I mean, it really isn't all that long ago that the death penalty for heresy was abolished. So I just think it's a bit rich to claim that Christianity has always been free.
Very well. So, you had a question?
So, you said that you've done some research and looked at the Bible and looked at the facts that stood out to you as coming through right now, and I saw about 30 on there, and I mean, I read the Bible and there are a lot more than 30 facts in it, and I'm wondering how you accounted for the concept of fits and misses.
I couldn't quite hear you. The Bible has 30 what?
So,
not Bible, your computation had about 30 facts that you correlated between the Bible and the cosmic universe. But there's this concept called alternates and misses, which is where you cherry pick what's correct from a model. And I'm wondering how you accounted for that when you did the research.
Okay, I'm not sure I got your question right, so if it didn't, please respond. I think you're commenting that maybe I was cherry-picking from the Bible the stuff mm-hmm. that really looked good in terms of... it could seem that way. We do have a CD of my story of how my astronomy brought me to the Christian faith. And my story is I didn't meet Christians till I was 27. And I was very skeptical that any of these holy books would actually be from the creator of the universe. And I spent 18 months going through the Bible searching for a provable error or contradiction. And if I found one, I was prepared to reject the Bible and the Christian faith. And so I don't think I was cherry-picking. I was really looking for evidence so that I could reject the Bible as the Word of God, just like I was going through the Hindu Vedas, the Buddhist commentaries, the Quran, the writings of Mormonism. I was really of the persuasion. These are all humanly crafted frauds. But my failure to find any error, scientifically or historically, in the Bible is what persuaded me this has got to be from a superhuman element.
Okay, so then, hits and misses is a completely, every human is capable of doing one and doesn't. And it's where when you did your research, you looked at each fact, and if it didn't correlate with cosmic evidence, you said, well, I'll interpret it in a different way. So, for example, the idea that Eve was created from Adam's side, you interpreted it in a completely different way from these, as the gentleman there said, very vague words, which could mean any of thousands of different things. So I'm wondering how you accounted for that mathematically when you did the research.
Okay, that's a good question. There are parts of the Bible that I still today don't understand what the meaning or interpretation of that is. But there are parts of the Bible that are very clear in what they communicate. And it's kind of like that in science, too. There's parts of the scientific revelation where there's really no ambiguity. And so what I was looking for was not a possible error in the Bible or a possible contradiction, but a provable contradiction or error. I felt if I found that would be a good basis for rejecting the Bible as a communication from God. So I still have issues with the Bible, just like I have issues with cosmology and astrophysics. We haven't got everything figured out. But what I notice in the scientific record, everything that we do understand with clarity fits together in a consistent way. There does seem to be this obedience to the scientific enterprise. The scientific method is based on the presumption that we live in a consistent, reliable, and logical universe. Well, I applied the same principle to the Bible. And so if I can find a provable error, in fact, if you can point one out to me, I'm willing to adjust my belief system. Often when I do these university events, one of the atheist science professors will say, can you give me a scientific discovery that would cause you to abandon your Christian faith? Well, I can give you a couple. If we were to prove definitively that the universe had no beginning, no space-time beginning, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith because the Bible so clearly teaches that in a variety of passages. If we were to prove that human beings have no distinction relative to any other of the life forms on planet Earth, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. Now, there are other scientific discoveries that would be corrosive.
Because I'm conscious that there are a lot of other questions in the room. So you've had your hand up for ages.
Yeah, my question is for Dr. Ross.
Poor Dr. Ross. He's getting all the questions. Carry on.
You can definitely help out. Because it's about biology. One of the crucial things you said about evolution was that there's this theory that mammals above 7 pounds would go extinct or something close to that. It wasn't very clear. If you could just explain that and how that actually is, you know, somehow disproving evolution, I would. Because it's just not very clear to me.
Right. Well, you'll find some articles in our reasons.org website that talk about these recent studies. You can go to that for the details. But basically, it comes from conservation biologists, where they're actually looking at what happens to mammalian species that have these large body sizes and, you know, doing long-term evolution experiments to see what's happening to the morphology in the DNA, and then trying to build a long-term model based on that. And what they're pointing out is that what we see in field biology is that mammals that are, say, a few grams or a few ounces do a whole lot better in terms of survivability against environmental stress than mammals that have large body sizes. And indeed, half of the mammal species that were here when human beings first showed up are now extinct. And what we notice is that the larger body size ones that are in the most trouble in terms of trying to survive. And, you know, we kind of look at the last 50,000 years. 4,000 species of mammals have gone extinct. Not a single new one has showed up to replace those 4,000.
Okay, so you in the corner there?
Yeah, I just had a question for Professor Lewis Walker. So a few Russians come here and he's come up, presented his point, he's given us a lot to think about scientifically that there may be a God. You haven't really come along and presented your idea that there isn't a God, you've just disproved his points. What do you believe? What do you think?
My own belief is there is no God, but I have no evidence for that because I don't have any evidence that there is a God. And also the idea of a God goes so much in my mind against biology and physics that I don't believe there is one. But I must admit, I think if there were a God, I think a God would actually do something at least once every year. And I would have to say, well, I'm wrong. Look, once again, on Christmas Day, God has done something absolutely extraordinary we cannot explain. But I'm terribly sorry that doesn't happen.
Accept this idea as plausible and come up with evidence to disprove it, you just say it can't be true right from the start.
Well, there's no plausible evidence for God.
I think you're often equivocal.
No, well, I, you know, sorry.
I don't think all of us physicists are wrong.
Yes. Sorry.
Okay, so I had...
Well, not very sorry.
The lady in the white top up there.
I was just wanting to say that when you were... You were trying to find a text that could explain the question that we couldn't explain through science. Am I right? You think about or?
Now, my perspective was, if there is a book that's actually being communicated to humanity by the creator of the universe, it's going to be a book that's going to be error-free with respect to science, history, and geography. I would also expect it to have predictive power, predict things that the writers at that time would have no knowledge of.
Why did you go and look for that book?
Oh, so what started your journey through the religious texts? Good question.
Okay. Well, I got interested in astronomy when I was 7. In fact, I knew that would be my future career from the age of 8 onwards. I was a very serious student of astronomy during my growing up years. And when I was 16, I spent a whole year just looking at cosmology, the origin and structure of the universe. And that was a time when there were a lot of competing models to explain the universe, steady state, hesitating universe, the Big Bang. But even at that time, the observational evidence was heavily favoring Big Bang cosmology. And with Big Bang cosmology, you've got a beginning. With a beginning, you've got a beginner who operates beyond space and time. So that's when I became persuaded that God exists.
So basically, science couldn't explain the beginning, so you wanted to find something that could explain the beginning. So what do people think?
Well, my astronomy persuaded me there had to be this being beyond space and time that created everything. What I wanted to do is go to the next step and say, is it possible that this being desires to communicate with his human beings, or does he just simply stay hidden behind the space-time realm? And frankly, I started off with a presumption that God wouldn't be that interested in communicating with beings on an insignificant speck we call planet Earth. But when I looked at the different holy books, I was expecting all of them to be humanly crafted frauds, and was rather surprised that the Bible was not of that character. And so that's what persuaded me to sign my name in the back of a Gideon Bible, giving my life to Christ. And 8 years later at Caltech, I met Christians for the first time.
Okay, so I think we've probably got time for one more question. I'm conscious that the guy over there in the red shirt had his hand up for quite a long time. And I'm sure that afterwards, both Dr. Hugh and Professor Lewis will probably be around to answer your questions. So if you'd like to take the last question of the evening.
No pressure.
No pressure.
I like how you use kind of science evidence as you described it, although it could be interpreted in different ways to kind of back your point. And I think religion people need to do that more often. But I think if you'd said to me, here's a religion that believes in cosmological constant and formation of stars and all this, I'd be on that religion. I believe I am. I'm taking a physics course. But I think with Christianity, the main beliefs are not that essentially, I mean, it's Christ. That's the main belief, and that hasn't really been explained at all by this kind of this agent that's outside the universe. What's happened is you said that God has gone and impregnated a virgin through this other dimension, which doesn't really get explained. But I'd like to look from both perspectives, how for you, how that relates your physics to the virgin conception, also from a biological point of view, about the same way.
Well, I'll go first, if you like. I think you already stated it, that the Christian position is that the Holy Spirit, one member of the triune God from outside of space and time, visited the Virgin Mary and did something inside of her womb that led to the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. And you know, theologians debate exactly what that something was. The Bible doesn't clarify that. But it does say that the Holy Spirit did something in the womb of the Virgin Mary that led her to give birth to Jesus of Nazareth. I'm willing to accept that as a miracle from beyond space and time.
I certainly won't accept it. I'm terribly sorry. If you want to have a baby, you need a sperm.
Do you not think that violates the kind of physical laws that you say were created, you know, by God in the beginning? That he set these laws and he didn't touch those up. And by going back and doing this, he's kind of violated his own order, showing that they're not constant physical
law. Okay, you're making a good point there, that the Christian faith stipulates that God is free to perform a variety of miraculous interventions. One category is where God miraculously intervenes from completely outside of space and time. The creation of the universe would be in that category. The virgin birth would be in that category. Jesus walking in water would be in that category. It violates the laws of physics, but the one that created the laws of physics can do that. But a second kind of miracle God does is where he miraculously intervenes within the laws of physics. And most of the miracles we see described in the Bible are in that category. So, for example, God coming and taking the dust of the earth and making the body of Adam. That would be an example of God performing a miracle within the laws of physics. Then in Colossians, it talks about how God sustains the laws of physics, that if God were to remove his sustaining effect, all the particles in the universe would collapse. Every being on the face of the earth would breathe its last breath. So there's three different categories by which God miraculously intervenes, and all three are scientifically testable.
Okay, so I think if we could have concluding remarks from both speakers now, we'll sort of bring the evening to the close. If you want to go first.
Well, I'm going to conclude by saying I'm terribly impressed by your remarks. I mean, it all seems extremely clever, but I'm terribly afraid that I'm totally, utterly unpersuaded, partly because I don't understand it, and partly because I think the evidence for God is just so terrible. And what I really want to say is one of the peculiar things that I hear in the discussion is that God has got all these human qualities. You know, he's sort of, he's superhuman, and that fits in ideally with my origin of belief in gods, because they did have human qualities. And if you want it, and I keep coming back to saying, if you're looking for false statements in the Bible, the way Adam was created and the way Eve was created are simply scientifically false, and there is no way of avoiding it.
Okay, so if we could have your closing remarks, Dr. Ross.
Well, I think it's important that we try to understand the argument. So I appreciate your point that maybe you haven't gone through the physics training, but I don't think it's difficult to do. And you know,
I think a lot of people in this room would disagree with you on that.
Well, this is what we try to do at Reasons to Believe. We publish books at a high academic level so that the academics can really verify our integrity and credibility, but then we try to bring up books at a very lay level. So one book I've written is Why the Universe is the Way It Is, which explains these concepts at a very lay level, because we want you to understand and verify for yourself that what we're claiming really does have credibility and integrity. And if I could just quote the Apostle Paul, everything must be tested, hold fast to that which is good. There are ways to test for a Christian worldview. There are ways to test for a non-theistic worldview, or a deistic worldview. And so let's apply these tests. You know, I believe God gave us the book of nature so that we can verify worldview concepts. Let's put the different competing models to the test, count on advancing scientific research, giving us more testing tools, and may the best model win, and may we be willing to submit to the best model.
Okay, so I think if we could show our appreciation for both guest speakers.